There's always two sides to every game. Welcome to the Game of Two Halves podcast with Tom Tozer and Chris McManus.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Game of Two Halves podcast, second episode. I'm Tom Tozer.
And I'm Chris McManus. And today we're going to be giving you our top five volleys of all time. We've got an interview with Graham Sharp, who was PR and head of media for William Hill for many years. We're turning back time on some of our best memories in football. And we've also got an interview with Paul Armstrong, who was editor and producer for the BBC, working on things like Match of the Day and the Olympics for 17 years. So first off, we're going to give you the volleys. So Tom, what's your top five volleys?
Well, we've got some great volleys in here today, guys. Just remember, obviously, there are many, many great volleys out there, but these are our top five. So without further ado, let's start off with my number. Fantastic volley there by Cristiano Ronaldo. I think, Chris, I think the thing about that volley so synonymous with it was the commentary by Darren Fletcher. As soon as that ball was coming in, you could see that he was shaping up for it. And when it went into that bottom corner, everyone just went absolutely wild. I remember the Juventus fans at the time, everyone even stood up to applaud it because it was just a fantastic goal.
Yeah, and also it's the importance of the goal as well. Being in the Champions League, one of the biggest competitions in football, and as you said, it was one of the best overhead kicks. The technique in it was unbelievable. I'm actually surprised it's not higher up your list, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I'm surprised that as well. But there were areas that I really do enjoy, and we'll go through those. So without further ado, we will move on to my number four.
Given away to Kagawa. Now Rooney. And Percy making a trademark run again. And what a ball to pick him out. And what a finish. A magnificent goal by Robin van Persie.
Guys, what can I say about that absolutely stunning volley from Robin van Persie against Aston Villa? I think one of the best things about this is the ball from Wayne Rooney from the halfway line. You can see as soon as it's on its trajectory, when it's right at the top of its height, when it's coming down, you can see that Van Persie is making that run off and he's ready just to absolutely hit it as soon as it drops to his foot. And when he hits it so sweet that the keeper's got no chance.
Definitely. The ball from Rooney, as you said, you know Rooney to be able to do that throughout his career, but that ball is just, it's pinpoint. I don't think Van Persie would have won it anywhere else, to be honest, apart from there. It was absolutely perfect.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, moving on to my number three.
Three in the box waiting for the cross, and it was Bale! Oh, what about that? What about that from Gareth Bale? Off the bench with a fabulous finish. Real Madrid 2, Liverpool 1, a classic Champions League final goal from Gareth Bale.
One of my favourite former Tottenham players there, Gareth Bale, scoring an absolutely fantastic overhead kick against Liverpool in a Champions League final. I don't think this volley gets enough credit, purely because it was in the same year as Ronaldo's overhead kick against Juventus.
But yeah.
I think this one's better, because it's a little bit further out. The angle he hits it at and the height he gets on it, to get it into the top of the net rather than the bottom where Ronaldo's went, I think is absolutely fantastic. And the ball for Ronaldo's volley was a lot easier for him to get that because he had a lot more space. Bale had people around him and he had to get the right angle and the right hit on it. And I think it was an absolutely fantastic volley.
Yeah, definitely. Couldn't agree more. And again, Champions League final against Liverpool. Everyone knows what Liverpool's like in a Champions League final. So to be able to score that is unbelievable. And they went on to win the cup that year as well. So very important goal for himself and for Madrid.
Very important goal. So without that, let's move on to my number two.
Danny Rose!
Oh, what a shot!
That's extraordinary! It's come 9 minutes into his Premier League debut. And he's written himself forever into Tottenham folklore.
I think many of you thought that Tottenham 1 would be number 1. Unfortunately, he has made it to number 1. Danny Rose's volley against Arsenal, personally, as a Tottenham fan, was one of my favourite era Tottenham goals. I watched the game. It was Danny Rose's debut. As it says, it was 9 minutes into his debut. I don't think anybody expected that from him. He comes in from the corner. He gets punched out. And he just... A lot of the time when you see defenders do that, you think, oh my God, the defender's going to hit it and it's just going to go skyrocket across over the bar or wherever. This one just arrowed. And the thing that was so good about it, it went through, went just over a crowd of players, but he went into the middle of the net.
Yeah.
Angled in either of the corner. So I think that's what's better about it, is that it went into the middle of the net and it had to go just through a crowd of players in the box.
Definitely. What I like about your volleys that you've chosen is the importance of them all. They're either in the Champions League or like this one, it's a North London derby, and as you said, Danny Rose, 9 minutes into his debut. I can imagine every Tottenham fan thought he was better than sliced bread after that. But it is an amazing volley, and Danny Rose is an amazing player as well. He went on to do brilliant things at Tottenham, and now he's moved to Newcastle, so he is a quality player.
Like you said, all of my volleys have had significance, especially with my number one.
That's a good ball for Roberto Carlos. Hooked into the penalty area towards Zidane. Oh, fantastic! Fantastic!
This volley, for me, out of this world, from an absolute world-class player in Zinedine Zidane. He didn't get off the ground for this one. He was on a standing foot. For it to, it was, the ball from Roberto Carlos was so high because it had a deflection. It was hooked up into the air. And for Zidane to swivel his body with his left foot and just hit it so sweet to go past the Leverkusen keeper, absolutely fantastic. And I just think to do that in a Champions League final, I've seen that goal so many times, and that's become such a standout part of Zidane's career. Obviously, we know other standout parts of how he bowed out in the World Cup, etc. But I think for his goals and the way he played, I think that goal for Real Madrid against Leverkusen was so standout, and that's why that was my number one.
Yeah.
Let's move on to your top five.
Okay, so coming in at fifth place is this goal.
They put their foot on the throttle in the second half. Headed out by McCann. How? Paul Scholes with the most brilliant goal.
So that's Paul Scholes obviously scoring against Aston Villa. The reason it's in there is just everyone knows Paul Scholes, great, great player. But just the way he watches the ball come down after he got cleared, and the connection was so sweet. It was only going in one place. And out of all of Paul Scholes' volleys and goals, I think that is probably top draw for any player. But for Paul Scholes, that was definitely top draw. So that's,
yeah, I agree. I think that's an absolutely fantastic volley. Obviously, after it comes out after the corner, the way he catches it and arrows into the top corner, I think that's an absolutely great volley.
Definitely. So, coming in at number four is this one.
Well, Hart didn't quite get that right. Oh, look at that! That is absolutely astonishing! You won't see a better goal than that this season. He's got all four, and Sweden have rather embarrassed him into the second half.
So, as you saw there, it was Zlatan scoring against England. I had to put it in there just because of the audacity for a player to try that from, 30 yards out, and for it to come off as well. I know the keeper was off his line, but he couldn't even see the goal when he made connection with it. He saw what he predicted what was going to happen, and he's gone towards that, so he knew what was going to happen. He knew the keeper was going to come out, so he stopped, turned round, waited for it to drop, and then just pinged it, and it's gone in, luckily. But I'm sure you do that 10 times in training and only one of them goes in, but it was just on his day that day.
Yeah, and I think what's important about that goal is that in that game he scored all four, and that was his fourth. And for his fourth to be as audacious as that is what made it a little bit extra special. Unfortunately, it was against England, but you can't always help that.
No, and he's a great player as well. I'm a massive Zlatan fan. So coming in at number three then is this one.
There's Valencia. Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Mkhitaryan in the middle! That is special! This famous stadium has seen some wonderful goals down the years. That is right up there.
Right then, that was obviously Mkhitaryan against Sunderland. I just think that was an absolutely audacious volley to do a scorpion kick like that and actually score from it. Obviously, you see Giroud do it, but I think the speed and the pace that the cross came in from Mkhitaryan was a bit quicker. And the technique that he had, it actually, I think he meant it a bit more than what Giroud did. It was very close between them two for this one.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to disagree with you on that one. I personally would have put Giroud's volley in there because it's a little bit higher up and Giroud called it as he was coming down. Giroud was already going towards the floor. It felt like Mkhitaryan, although he's had more pace and the cross was a lot more speed, I felt like Giroud's is a little bit more technical.
That's fair enough. But yeah, that's my top five. Going on to number two now. So here it is.
By Mark Vivian Foet, Sinclair's cross over Cunningham. Di Canio! I do not believe that. That is sensational.
So, as you can see there, that is Di Canio scoring against Wimbledon. Had to be a West Ham player in there somewhere. But with this one, I think it's the way that the ball's crossed and he watches it and then he just makes that scissor kick and it goes in the bottom corner. And I think Di Canio was a very good player. In all the ways he played, he was a very frustrating player sometimes because he got so angry and so emotional about the game. But on the other hand, when things like that come off, it is unbelievable. Everyone hears about whenever he walks off the pitch because he hasn't got a penalty or when he pushes referees and the other side of Di Canio, but that just shows the true quality of that of Di Canio as a player.
Yeah, I think what's good about that volley as well is that it's a scissor kick. It's a little bit, it's got like something a little bit different about it when he actually hits it on the volley. And I think that's what makes that different out of all the volleys, even mine and yours. It's a little bit different because he had a little bit of flair into it. And that's what makes that volley so good.
Definitely. And then my number one is this one.
Nani.
So, as you can see there, that's Rooney scoring against Man City. Whether it comes off his shin, I don't really mind. I think this is number one for me because of the absolute importance of it. Because at that time, all United fans were calling for Rooney's head. He wasn't getting along with Sir Alex Ferguson. He wasn't playing great. And then for him to pull that off when he's not in his form and against City as well, to go on and win the game. And obviously, that goal was a big goal for Rooney as he stays at the club for a couple more seasons and does very well. And it's like that goal seemed to make everything okay for him and for the club. It was a very hard time for Rooney, I'm sure, as well as all the fans, but it was just a brilliant goal.
Yeah, I agree with you, number one. I think that goal is an advert for the Premier League. If you want to know what the Premier League's about and the passion and the goals that are scored, you just take a look at Wayne Rooney's overhead kick. And yeah, I totally agree with that being at your number one. So guys, that was our top five volleys for this week. We will be moving on to our second section. We were lucky enough this week to speak with Graham Sharp, who worked for William Hill for 45 years. He worked in various sports and worked within public relations. And Graham was happily enough to take his time out to speak to us.
All right, Graham, thank you very much for taking the time out to talk to us there on the Game of Two Halves podcast. Just kind of wanted to start off, you worked for William Hill within public relations for 45 years. Infamously, you co-founded the William Hill Sportsbook of the Year Award. What was kind of the thinking behind that initiative and how did it come about?
Well, I'd rather hope it was famously rather than infamously, but there you go. Can't please everybody.
Sorry, that's probably a miswording on my part.
There was a chap called John Gaustad who opened the first ever dedicated sports bookshop in the UK. It was called Sports Pages, and it was in just off of Tottenham Court Road, Charing Cross Road in London. And unbeknown to each other, he and I both had had an idea for a sportsbook of the year. John had the idea and had a venue to host it at, but had no money to do it with. I had some money to do it with, but no venue to host it at. So it was just a matter of putting the two of us together, and neither of us could ever actually remember how we did that. But at some point, one of us got in touch with the other. I think I heard of him and dropped him a line. Anyway, we had a meeting, got together, and it was as though we thought we'd discovered gold, and then we looked at each other and said, but who gives a damn what we think is the best sports book of the year? Ah, yes, we said. To mean anything, it has to be a respected judging panel. But the slight problem was we wanted to give a decent prize to the winning author, and the budget that I had wouldn't go far beyond that. So what we did, we took a bold chance, and via a third person in the room, Tim Moss, who helped me out with PR at Hills, we decided, well, nothing ventured, nothing gained, and we wrote to Ian Waldridge, Hugh McElvanney, the two most respected sports writers in the land at that time, and also to a couple of other people at the same time, Harry Carpenter, you know, then in his pomp as a boxing commentator, and Cliff Morgan, the famous rather than infamous Welsh rugby legend and broadcaster. And we sat back and waited for the four rejection slips. But we didn't get four rejection slips. We got four acceptance notes, all saying, yes, we'd love to do it. We told them that all we could afford to do for them was give them a slap-up meal and as much drink as they fancied at that slap-up meal. And we were off and running. So then it was a matter of advertising for entries, which the publishers were quite keen to send us. And we were away. And initially, in the first year, the prize was £1,000. And you know, it went well. The winning book the first year was True Blue, about the Oxford boat race, which rather upset my managing director, because he said, how can you bet on the boat race other than who's going to win it out to? You know, couldn't you have given it to a book about the Grand National? And we said, it doesn't work like that, John. You know, it goes to the best book. And that's what we've stuck to all the way through. It doesn't matter if it's something obscure. It doesn't matter if it's a sport that the company could or couldn't bet on. It's the best book according to the judges. And you know, now the award is over 30 years old, and I think it's not only made quite a few authors independent enough to be able to write without needing a job because they've won the award, and has created a whole library effectively in which anybody coming to sports books for the first time can choose, safe in the knowledge that whatever book they choose that's been shortlisted for the William Hill is going to be well worth reading. And my only one regret about the whole award is that what I think is the best sports book ever written didn't win it, and it was a football book, The Miracle of Castel di Sangro. And it will be one of, I wasn't on the judging panel that year, so I had no influence in what was going to win it. And yeah. I was gutted that it didn't.
And I think, are you still advising on the panel at this moment in time?
I no longer work for Hills, but I'm still connected with the award. I wasn't last year and won't be this year actually on the judging panel, but I'm involved in the earlier stages where, you know, we cut down the runners from the last year, I think, to 150 odd books that were entered, and we need about 20 or so to choose a long list from, and that's pretty difficult.
Any books that you've picked out so far? That
very early days. I mean, the situation is not helping publishers at the moment, and I think some of the publishers are holding back their projected better contenders. So we've had, I think, just short of 20 entries so far, which in itself is not particularly unusual, because they tend to come in a huge rush as we go through summer. So I suspect we'll still get a good, if slightly less than usual, entry, but that will just reflect the times we're in. You know, we can't do anything about that, and somebody will still win it, so that's all important.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, I know a lot of people have enjoyed reading some of the books from the Sportsbook of the Year Awards, so let's hope it continues.
Yeah, I'm pleased to hear that.
And has a long success.
That'll be well, it has, you know, 30-plus years. I regard that as my, what would you call, legacy to William Hill, really. It was an idea that I and John Gaustad thought was a potential winner. We had to put it together and then nurture it over the years. But we've been well supported by sports journalists, and I think it's only been a positive for sports publishing, and particularly books about football.
Brilliant, Graham. That's a really good story. And as you said, a legacy that you've left with William Hill that's probably going to continue for a very long time.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you about, I saw that you had the chance to have an interview with Elton John. So tell me a bit about that. How did it come about and what happened?
All the way through school, the only thing I ever wanted to do was be a journalist. And I opted not to try to go to university or anything. I applied to scores of local newspapers to get a foot in the door as a journalist, and I finally got one on the Weekly Post group of newspapers, which functioned in Northwest Middlesex, where I live, and we had at our peak, I think, about a dozen editions running from my own sort of native Harrow through to Ealing, Greenford, Southall, Northall, I think went as far as Watford at one point. One of my other interests at the time was vinyl records, which it still is. In fact, my most recent book was called Vinyl Countdown. It's about my love of records, record collecting and record shops. And I was a record reviewer on the Weekly Post. And so the switchboard knew if anybody rang up with anything to do about with the charts or new releases, they'd put them through to me. On this particular day, a chap came on and said, my name is Elton John. He said, well, it's not really, it's Reg Dwight. He said, and I live in your circulation area in Pinner, and I thought you might like to write about the fact that my new record called Lady Samantha has been selected by Tony Blackburn as a record of the week. And I was sort of in my late teens then, maybe suffering delusions of grandeur, and like a lot of people at that time, the name of Tony Blackburn, one which I've learned to love over the years, was not regarded as being particularly trendy in those days, and anything that was nominated by Tony as his record of the week would be looked down upon by, you know, those of us who thought we moved in the higher musical circles. So I said to him, well, I'm sure your career may recover from such a letdown, but let's see if I can find anybody that wants to write about you, because unfortunately I've got a few stories to write to get onto my front page at the moment. And I put my hand over the receiver and said to the room, some chap on here, I think, called Reg John or Elton Dwight, says he's got a record out that Tony Blackburn rather likes, and would we like to write about him because he lives in Pinner? And there was complete and utter silence from the other reporters who were busy on their own stories. And the only one who responded was our chief reporter, Bill Kello, who said, who was at the time combing his moustache, which he was wont to do, and looked over and said, well, I haven't got anything better. They bung him on to me. So I did. I bunged him on to Bill, and Bill arranged to meet him with a photographer, and a story duly appeared in the Weekly Post. And when many years later, for this book that I wrote recently, I wanted to authenticate that story, having told it many, many times, and began to think, well, could it really have been like that? I found an album of Elton's Captain Fantastic, I think, which came with a little booklet, which included lots of his earliest publicity mentions. And there, in the beginning section of that, was a photograph of him and Bernie Taupin both performing some sort of star jump, wearing what looked to be like Afghan jackets, which were trendy at the time. And there was the piece down the side that my colleague Bill had written, in which he managed to misspell Bernie Taupin's name three times. And that's how I knew it was authentically our story, because we never spell anybody's name the same way twice. That's one of the things that you soon learn in local newspapers. Somehow people's names always come out wrong.
Yeah.
But yes, Elton, that launched Elton on his lengthy career. And has he ever bothered to send me a Christmas card to say thanks? No.
That's an absolutely fantastic story. This next thing I kind of wanted to move on to, Graham. Obviously, from working for William Hill for such a long period of time, you see how gambling adapted over the years. Kind of particularly wanted to move on to gambling in football. There's been so many stories, headlines from professional footballers or about gambling addictions. There's slogans out there as such. What I want to know is, your time at William Hill, did William Hill, what did William Hill do to combat this as such? Were there any initiatives that you guys took on in that regard?
Well, it's difficult to find an initiative. We are aware, as are those who work in many different industries, that there will be a small number of people who may, in some respects, abuse their use of that industry, whether it be people that buy cars they can't afford, or drink too much, or smoke too much, or bet too much. It's not in those companies' interests, be they bookmakers or car makers or whatever, to encourage people to do that, because it can only produce negative publicity for you. However, I don't believe, you know, in my 45 years, and I worked with a lot of different managing directors, and I attended a lot of high-profile meetings, etc. I never, ever got the feeling that we were interested in encouraging people to bet beyond their means. What we wanted to do was encourage people to have a regular bet and enjoy it. We didn't, you know, where's the use to our company if somebody bets so much that they lose their job and therefore can't afford to bet at all? So one of my roles in the earlier days that I was at the company was to popularise betting and to make people aware that there was a big range of things they could bet on, including football, and also to sort of make the message: we don't want anybody to abuse the facilities that a bookmaker can offer. But I feel that it's gone too far the other way. I mean, it seems to me totally ridiculous, and I'm giving anything away. My son works in a football capacity, but only at a local level. Yet if he were to want to have a bet on, let's say, Liverpool winning the Premier League, he would run the risk of getting the sack. You know, this is absolutely ludicrous. It's overkill, isn't it? Why and where should people be stopped, even if they are professional footballers, from having a bet on the sport that they're involved in? Would you expect Lewis Hamilton to not be interested in cars and, you know, not be able to go and buy a car of an alternative supplier if he wanted to? So I understand that some people have a problem with it, but it seems to me that the pendulum has moved a little too far, and now there seems to be the thought that the business should be run to suit the very few people that have a problem with it, and nobody has yet properly defined the word problem gambler to me. Because how can you know? If somebody comes on and says, I'd like to have a bet of £20, £50, £100, £1,000, £5,000, if they can produce the proof that they possess that sort of money, at what point does it become the responsibility of the company to whom they're giving it, be it me trying to buy a vinyl record which is being sold by somebody for £1,000? There are people who think that might be irresponsible, but I wouldn't. If I wanted to buy a rare record for that amount of money, why shouldn't I, if I can afford to do it? And in the same way, if somebody wants to place £1,000 on the outcome of a football match or competition, and they have the money, surely it's their responsibility to ensure that they can afford that, because how can I know? If they've got the money, they've got the money. And if they tell me they can afford it, then they can afford it. And there has to be an element of personal responsibility at the end of the day. And I don't think it's an industry which is deliberately set out to try and force people to bet beyond their means. Now, I'm obviously not speaking on behalf of William Hill here or anybody else in the bookmaking industry, because I'm no longer directly involved with it, just of my own experiences. Yes, as I say, I think people should have the freedom to have a bet on events. Obviously, I wouldn't support a footballer having a bet on his own team losing any more than I would support a jockey having a bet on his horse losing. Yeah. You know, there will always be some people who are criminally minded But that's the same in any industry, and it's often been the case that bookmakers over the years have been able to point out potential criminality where they've seen unusual amounts of money for the outcome of a particular match and have been able to draw that to the attention of the authorities. So in that respect, they've been able to produce a positive result from unusual betting patterns.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Graham, to be honest. I know some people that frown upon betting, but...
Well, there will always be people who frown upon anything, won't they? And so it has to be reasonable frowning, you know? Yes, you don't like it, but it happens and it's legal. Let people do it if they want to. Don't get on their backs and tell them they're doing something awfully corrupt or terrible or potentially destroying of their lives and careers, because that's not the case for the vast majority of people. And whilst, of course, I have every sympathy for people who believe they can't control whether it's their gambling, their drinking, their eating, their smoking, or whatever it may be, I feel that there are organisations which are there to help them, and if they can help them, that's great. But ultimately, they have to take the decision. For example, they can self-exclude themselves from having a bet. And then often when that's done, maybe a percentage of them will then try and get round their own self-exclusion. And if they do that, then they'll blame the bookmaker for letting them do it. But, you know, it's not a case of being allowed to do it. It's a case of them getting around the rules and enabling themselves to do it. So
I think that's where I stand. On that point that you just made as well, I think the way things are going as well, so it's not your typical high street bookmakers anymore. You've got your Coral and your Ladbrokes, but a lot of them have gone onto the applications. And with that, with the people taking their personal responsibility, I think that with the apps, they've got a very good protocol in place to be able to let people do that, where they have a maximum, they can bet a month and things like that.
Yeah.
So it is down to people taking the accountability for it as well.
Yeah, things have changed.
I totally agree with that point. I think, Chris, you say a lot of people blame the bookmakers, and people say, well, it's bookmakers' fault. No, it's not. It is down to the accountability of the individual.
Yeah, do you blame a car maker for a bad driver?
Yeah, exactly.
That is it. Just moving on to the next point, because we talk about people gambling too much or people that are frowned upon it all night. But moving on to the next point, I just wanted to talk about around sort of sponsorship deals, because obviously bookmakers have a big sort of emphasis or a big part to play in sports, because it's their core business. But how do you feel about being shirt sponsors for football teams and things like that?
Well, it didn't happen in the earlier days when I was at the company, and football betting for sure has become far more popular over the years, and obviously that runs in tandem with the fact of how visible it now is on our screens. You know, back in the day, you could only watch the FA Cup final and occasional England internationals as live football matches on your television, and so there wasn't a great demand from people to bet on those events, because traditionally people like to have a bet and then to watch the event that they bet on. But as football became ubiquitous on the television, so of course interest in betting on those games that people are going to watch. If you're not a Manchester United supporter or a Liverpool supporter and you're watching United play Liverpool, well, you can become a supporter for 90 minutes when you have a fiver on one of the teams to win, and it adds an extra interest in the game. And so the betting aspect has grown along with the amount of televised games there are, and now there are very few games that aren't televised. So naturally, because there's that interest, the bookmakers would want to get involved by sponsoring clubs, and clubs, you know, clubs benefit from sponsorship, and they don't have to accept a particular offer from a company to sponsor. But if they decide to accept a bookmaker's offer, then again, why should they not do that? You have to be a certain age to have a bet. I understand that some people think that underage people will be exposed to a betting message if there are bookmaker sponsors. But surely then that would be up to the TV companies to take a hand in as well and say, we won't accept showing that sort of sponsorship, or the television authorities to say it's not allowed. But as long as it's allowed, you can't blame a commercial business like bookmaking for wanting to be involved in that. And I think part of the problem when there are complaints about potential underage gambling has come about not because of bookmaker sponsorship, but because of the fact that the National Lottery, which was launched by the government, John Major, was made available to 16 and 17 year olds, and still is, whereas to have a bet with a bookmaker, it's always been, well, for recent years, 18 years old. So 16 and 17 year olds have had the impression that as they can bet on the National Lottery and the football pools, they can therefore bet with bookmakers, and they can't. So some of them will try to do that and get around the rules. But again, that's not because of what the bookmakers have done. It's because of the, you know, other elements of the betting industry.
Yeah, I think you're always going to see a divide between people, whether it's right or wrong, whether it's right to have for a club to be having a bookmaker sponsor on their shirt and for them to then support gambling addictions or trying to help people stop gambling. There's a multitude of different things that come into it, but I mean. Yeah,
it's slightly ironic that my own team, Luton Town, had publicly announced that they won't accept bookmaker sponsorship.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You know, I don't have a problem with that. If that's what the board wants to say, then that's fine. But they might also remember that when it was all the rage to have a betting shop in a football ground, the first football ground to have a betting shop in it was Kenilworth Road.
Oh, right. Okay. I did not know that. That's
it wasn't a Willing Hill shop, by the way.
That's fantastic, Graham. I wanna before we finish up. I read an interview online. I think it was not long after you finished up with William Hill. Kind of a couple of things in there that really intrigued me about some of the bets that you've seen. One particularly caught my eye was the grandfather of current Bournemouth player Harry Wilson.
Yeah, I was one of my ideas from early days at William Hill was that we should give people the opportunity to bet on the thing that they know most about, which is themselves and their families. And I sort of encouraged people to, if they wanted to have a bet on their newborn baby to grow up to achieve some form of sporting greatness or in other fields of human endeavour. And that became quite a popular thing to do, and I took hundreds, if not thousands, of them over the years. And a few years ago, I was down in Brighton, I think it was for a short holiday, and I got a phone call from somebody to say, had I watched the match in which Wales had played the previous night, and in which they brought on a young unknown player at the time called Harry Wilson, who had come on for the last couple of minutes. I think Chris Coleman had brought him on for the last couple of minutes of the game. And I said, yeah, vaguely noticed it. Should I have been particularly interested? I said, well, possibly, yes, because we've had his grandfather on the phone, and he's just reminded us that he backed Harry Wilson to win a Welsh cap when Harry Wilson was about 18 months old, I think. And I think I laid him rather generous odds of about 2,500 to one, and he had 50 quid on, if I remember correctly, which meant that all of a sudden, William Hill owed him 125 grand for the 2 minutes that he'd come onto the pitch for Wales. And, you know, that was a terrific story. It was brilliant publicity for William Hill, I have to say that. But it was also, you know, to me, that's how could anybody possibly object to that sort of bet? You, in this instance, it was grandfather rather than a father, he's had a betting slip for some 18 years that he's been showing his mates, you know, saying, look how proud I am of my grandson. I've backed him to win a cap for Wales. And they've all been laughing at him, saying, fat chance of that, mate. And then, sure enough, he's won 125 grand. But even if that hadn't happened, Harry had never played, you could show it to the lad or the daughter or whatever as they grow up and say, look, I've proved that I've got great faith in you going on to great things by having a bet on you as a kid, you know. If you don't do it, that's great. I don't mind. If you fancy doing it, I'll give you half the winnings.
Well, I'm going to safely say I don't think mine are Chris's parents or grandparents for those bets off.
Don't think so, no.
I don't think you'll get anywhere near that. Graham, thank you very much for taking the time out to talk to us. We really do appreciate your time. And we hope going forward, I think, like we said, there's always going to be a divide within the industry. But
yeah, and nobody likes losing money, do they? However it happens. So they're always going to be a bit bitter and fed up if they lose money. But anybody that backed the Spectre winner loves bookmakers. So there you go. Swings and roundabouts.
Fantastic. Graham, like we said, we hope the William Hill Sportsbook of the Year Award goes on for many, many years to come.
Right.
And we thank you again for your time. Graham, take care. Speak to
you
soon.
You're more than welcome. Thanks very much, Graham.
Thank you.
Cheers, boys. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Chris, what a fantastic interview we had there with Graham. I think Graham put across a lot of good points about gambling in sport and the way that he set up the William Hill Sportsbook of the Year Award. And I think it was really good to kind of get an insider's view on that and kind of what he thought about putting sponsorships on shirt and stuff.
Definitely, definitely. Even with the shirt sponsorships, as you just said, I don't think there's anything wrong with football teams having them as their first shirt sponsor. You look at West Ham, they had Bet365 for a long time. And I think there's a lot of clubs that do have betting companies as their shirt sponsor. And I don't see a problem with them getting involved in the sports in that way, you see other different sports and they have beer sponsorships and betting sponsorships. Sometimes that just doesn't happen over here. Even down to sponsorships of sort of the cup. It was the Carling Cup for so many years and then it got changed. And I just think everything's going in such a different direction. As Graham said on the interview, it's like a pendulum. It starts sort of neutral and then someone kicks up a fuss about betting or alcohol or cigarettes and then it goes the complete opposite way and then it takes some time for it to swing back round. But yeah, great interview with Graham Sharp there.
I've been looking forward to this part since we spoke about it this week. So guys, we're returning to our back time. And the best thing about this one is it involves each other's clubs, our memories, okay? Chris, I'm going to let you go take first on this one. So I'm going to let you go first with this one. So tell us your memory.
So, yeah, this is West Ham versus Tottenham. I think it was 2007. Me and Tom were actually in the pub together watching this game. What?
2017.
What did I say?
2007.
Oh, yeah. I meant 2017. It was October 2017. Took me a bit of time to dig out the video that you're going to see as well. So it's West Ham Tottenham. We were 2-0 down at half time. And then in the second half, I don't know what happened, but we came out. And it was probably the best 45 minutes of football that I've watched West Ham play for a while. Tom was singing and dancing to start with. And then Andre Ayew got a brace within sort of 8 minutes. And then, obviously, the big Italian stallion, Bonner, with that beautiful header at the near post to win it. It was a great moment in football. And the fact that I was with you and you're a Tottenham fan, it just made it 10 times better for me, to be honest.
Guys, as Royce, here's a little clip of that moment.
This is floated in, flicked into the net, and they've scored again. Ogbonna got his head to it in front of all of the Tottenham defenders. It's flashed past form, and it's 3-2. The Hammers were dead and buried at half-time, but they've come up with three goals in the space of a quarter of an hour, and Angelo Ogbonna has headed the Hammers into the lead for the first time. Tottenham 2, West Ham 3 at Wembley.
I still, to this day, am so gutted about that. I remember at half-time going, yeah, we've got this easy. We'll go through to the next round. First goal went in, I went, not worried. Second goal went in, I went, not worried. Third goal went in, I was like, right, that's that then. But Spurs wouldn't be Spurs without being Spursy, would they? No. So, moving on to my moment. Chris was fortunate enough not to be with me for this moment, but it does involve Tottenham and West Ham. This time, this one was at White Hart Lane. West Ham were 2-1 up at White Hart Lane. I think it was about 10, 15 minutes to go. Equalising goal came from Harry Winks. I think it was Harry Winks' first goal for the club, actually. Yeah. I was lucky enough to be at that game, and Harry Kane got a penalty in the last minute. And I'm not going to explain this to you. I'm just going to let the clip play out.
Come on, Harry!
As you can see, I went absolutely crazy. Harry Kane scores a last-minute penalty to win the game 2-3-2 for Tottenham. I called Chris on my way home on this one, and I think to give him quite a lot of stick for that, for them to be 2-1 up with only 10, 15 minutes to go and to lose it. It was quite remarkable for me. And it was fantastic for me to be there seeing that.
Yeah. What's it like when at White Hart Lane, whenever you're 2-1 down, and does the atmosphere drop a little bit? Was it a bit tense when you were there?
I was with a friend of mine at that game, and I actually, when we were 2-1 down with about 10-15 minutes to go, I actually turned around and said, "Should we go?" Because I thought we were going to lose, so I turned around and said, should we make a move? Can we get ahead of the traffic? Or should we get out of Tottenham? So he was insistent. He said, no, we'll stay to the end. We paid our money. And I'm looking at the clip. I'm very glad that we did. The atmosphere, I miss White Hart Lane so much because White Hart Lane's atmosphere was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. Even in the last season when it was missing a corner out of the stadium, it was absolutely fantastic. The atmosphere, I mean, any football club, wherever you go, the atmosphere is just different class for everywhere you go.
Definitely. And you said about missing White Hart Lane. Do you think, we'll probably talk about stadiums in the future, but I just want to get this one out of the way. Do you think the atmosphere has changed since you've got the new stadium?
Yeah, I've only been to one game this season. I went to the 3-2 home loss at Wolves. The atmosphere has definitely changed, but the atmosphere has only changed because of what's happened with the club this season, obviously, with Pochettino and the team performing poorly at the start, with Pochettino getting sacked and then Mourinho coming in and just the dynamic changing, but performance is still not picking up. So, I would say the atmosphere has changed, but I don't think we've got to see a full bouncing atmosphere at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium as yet. I would ask the same question of you. Obviously, we know West Ham fans absolutely miss Upton Park. I've been to Upton Park myself once, and it is a fantastic stadium. But obviously, the London Stadium just isn't what Upton Park was. I mean, what are your thoughts towards that?
Well, yeah, as you said, it is a weird one because it's a nice venue, but it's not a football venue. So what I mean by that, it's nice to look at and it's got a lot of seats and it's a sporting venue. But the difference between the likes of, if you look at the Dortmund Stadium, your stadium, what Chelsea are planning to do with their stadium, the seats are more raised. Even Nou Camp, they're raised, whereas this is more out. So it doesn't compact the sound as much, which does lose a bit of the atmosphere. Obviously, with Karen Brady being so active on social media lately, she said about the seats going closer to the pitch. They've got everything made for it. They just need the time to fit it. And with everything that's going on, they probably won't be able to do it this summer. So that is a bit unfortunate, but I'm hoping with that, it will bring it a bit closer. For me, it still doesn't feel like home, and we've been there, well, 4 years now. So it still doesn't feel like home for me, but I'm sure eventually it will. But I don't know if it's the fact that when we left the bowling, we were on such a high and we were performing well, and then we haven't picked it up I don't think we've learnt to play to that ground as much. If you look at the size of the pitch compared to the Bolin, if you look at Man City, when they come to the London Stadium, it's their ideal pitch because they can just ping the ball about. Even when we played Arsenal this season, we went 1-0 up and we just seemed to sit back and let them have the ball. And they just passed it about. And I knew that we was going to lose that game. And it was just, it's just not the way West Ham play by playing. Like, it's like a pitch for Pep Guardiola with the size of it. We used to like the tight, compact bowling ground with a small pitch where we can just hit players and they can't get enough time on the ball. But I'm sure one day it'll feel like home.
Yeah, you make some good points. I think for both our clubs, it is kind of just the crowds need to settle in. The teams need to regain confidence and they need to work their way back to what we both know that our teams can be. Guys, we'll move on to our second interview this week. We were lucky enough to interview Paul Armstrong, who edited and produced Match of the Day between 15 and 16 years, worked with the BBC, also worked on projects like the Olympics. And Paul, we were lucky enough for Paul to take time out to talk to us on the show. Paul, thanks very much for taking the time out to talk to us today on A Game of Two Halves. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very, very, very nice to see you both.
Hi, Paul.
Paul, what can we say? You've had the pleasure to edit and work on Match of the Day. I think it was around 14, 15 years.
Yeah. I was the editor for about 14 years. And before that, I'd been an assistant producer, but I worked on other things as well. But I did a lot of Match of the Day. I did a lot of different sports, but football was always the one I wanted to work on. So I sort of gradually moved towards it.
Fantastic. I think the first question I wanted to ask was the day-to-day running of the show. I mean, how did that go? Because obviously we now, obviously not at this moment in the current situation, but we're now used to seeing Gary Lineker put the rundown on Twitter or on social media. And how did that work? How was that put together before he started doing that?
Yes, good question. I mean, I opened up a Match of the Day editor's account a couple of years before he started going on Twitter. And because it was anonymous and because I was kind of tired by the time I came off the air, it always ended up in a squabble because it was amazing how seriously they take. I know we always kind of want, I mean, I was a Middlesbrough fan and we were often on near the bottom of the running order, but usually meant we were mid-table. But I did a book called Why We Always On Last, because it became so, you know, all important to people. So you'd come off the air and you think, well, West Brom 0, Stoke 0. Obviously that was the last game because, you know, they're both mid-table, it's 0-0. What else are we going to do? And people from West Brom and Stoke just took it as a personal affront. So you had about sort of 16 teams, really, in the Premier League who thought they were always on last. And then the others were, say, Man United, Liverpool, whatever, but they always thought you were doing them down. We're only on first if we lose, you know. Well, yeah, if you're Liverpool and you lose at Watford, you are going to be on first. You know, it was that kind of thing. But nobody ever, I mean, it became quite comical, which is why I called the book that. But basically, Lineker, about 2 years into this absolute mess, decided to do Twitter, which he'd never done, but he avoided it totally. And then somehow when he got into it, you've seen him now. He's almost like the leader, sort of second leader of the opposition, isn't he? He's kind of, you know, always he's always got something to say. He's always, yeah, but yeah, he's very good and he's clever at dealing with. He's not going to be bullied. He never was. He never was as a player or anything either. People want to shout abuse at him, he'll ignore it, or he'll come back at them if quite cleverly sometimes. And it was so good that he did that on Twitter because it just took it. Well, A, just took it away from me, and it gave it a personality. So it became part of the weekly routine. But in terms of how the running order came together, that was the editor's decision. So it always has been. I mean, back in the day when it was much simpler when I first started, because they basically had two main games. Then when the Premier League came, and literally whatever you had, you were stuck with. So you know, just two games, which one are you going to put first? Then the Premier League came along and they did a roundup. So you had sort of the goals from all of the games. There was a little bit of a running order thing about which are we going to feature first in the roundup and what we're going to talk about. So it was a bit of a pecking order, but it only really got going when we started to put commentary on every game, which was when we got the contract back in 2004. We lost it for 4 years to ITV, and when it came back, we decided there were so many cameras at so many games by that time that you could put a commentary on every game. Because before that, you had like single camera roundups, a bit like you'd see in the Football League now, where you couldn't do much with it apart from just show the goals. So from 2004 onwards, that became the massive thing about, we thought we were doing everybody a favour here, they'll see more of their teams. And actually it turned into, well, we might be on for 5 minutes now, but we're on last, you know, so it became, it sort of shifted from why are we always in the roundup getting 30 seconds to why, okay, yeah, we're showing more of us, we've got a commentary, but it's on last, and we're going to lose our rags with you. So that was still going on to this day. Every time you go on, I mean, I laugh every Saturday or when I look at what Lineker's dealing with, because it will be, by October, you'll have had 16 teams saying we're always on last. Yeah, just every season, whoever it is, it's just always Sheffield United, Norwich, whoever came up, they always think they're on last. Yeah, just
yeah.
The fact that everybody's saying, aren't Sheffield United fantastic, isn't it? It's brilliant. It doesn't seem to register. So if they draw 0-0 at Southampton and it's at the end of the programme, they're livid. So it's just, you can't win, really. So it's a very long answer to a simple question, but that's
fine. That's fine. It's a great answer.
Yeah, so in terms of yourself, because you said you're a football fan, you're a Middlesbrough fan, but how was it working for that amount of time with legends of the game, like you said, Gary Lineker and other players as well, coming on the show?
Well, Lineker was a brilliant thing for me. He wrote the foreword to my book. We're still in touch. I mean, I don't, obviously can't see it at the moment, but we were sort of on the same wavelength about how serious we thought sport was, like important, but not that important. You know, I was worked at the Hillsborough disaster. He just had that sort of instinct anyway, that this isn't life and death. I don't know why people take it quite this seriously. So we've had that in common, but also when he was coming through as a presenter, I was coming through as an editor. So I started editing some sort of football focuses and other little bits and pieces that he was doing. And he was a pretty new presenter and I was a pretty new editor. So we worked together for, you know, even longer than that, 14 years really. So yeah, we knew each other very well. So that was a real privilege. The pundits was interesting because when they first start, sometimes it's difficult because they still feel part of the game. It's like Shearer when he first started, thought, I still want to be a manager. I've got loads of friends still playing in the game. And it was always quite difficult for him to criticise them. And then I think once he went into management, it didn't, and you know, he took on an absolutely poison chalice at Newcastle. And after that, thought, he sort of got it out of his system. He didn't want to be a manager anymore. Then he just opened up. And and that was lovely to watch, the way that he just became, Ian Wright to an extent as well. Ian Wright was great, but he was just a bit of a comedian initially, really. He just kind of just thought he was there to give a bit of, you know, sort of just a few good lines, often good lines. He's a lovely bloke, but as it went on, and you see him now, he's even better now. He's become that combination has just kind of become the front line combination for Match of the Day, almost by how it's evolved. It was a real thrill. So, I mean, some of the people we worked with, I worked with Johan Cruyff, who was the person when I was a kid. I watched that World Cup, it was the first World Cup I watched in 74, and he just, the best thing I'd ever seen, you know, and then suddenly I found myself at Euro 2000 working with him. It was just extraordinary. So that one, there's one or two times, and I worked with Janino, and it was obviously the greatest Middlesbrough player of my lifetime. In Brazil in 2014, so those things are you can't get away from that. You're sort of in the presence of somebody that you've always watched and always. But actually, it's people. They're just people. You know, they're not. The lovely thing is that the football persona isn't necessarily what they're like privately. And most of them are lovely because they've been in dressing rooms. They're generally not massive egos. I mean, some, obviously they know that they're good, but they know that they can't be a complete prima donna. Unlike an individual sport, if they're in a dressing room, it's probably slightly changed these days. I mean, I'm sure Cristiano Ronaldo pouts around, you know, postures a bit in the Juventus dressing room, but you've still got 10 other people there, so you can't completely change them off. And the people who do, we tend not to put on the television, you know, the ones who are really abrasive, or if you're going to go on a trip to a World Cup, even if somebody might be good, you can't afford to have 5 weeks with somebody who's going to cause eruptions. So we always got sort of a team spirit going. And people would come in, and generally, what you often find was they wanted to learn. I mean, I remember working with Peter Schmeichel, because it was Peter Schmeichel. He just sort of, because he was speaking a second language, some of his answers on matches, they were too long, because you've got a minute out of a game, and he would talk for, like he was on the radio, for 5 minutes. And I sort of tried politely to say to him, look, can you just rein it, just be a bit more succinct, Peter, it's great, but you need to say in a minute what you're saying in 2 minutes. And he said, look, just tell me if I'm crap. He said, you know, if Roy Keane and Fergie could shout in my face, I'm not going to be worried about what you say to me. And I thought, well, yeah, okay, fair enough. I sort of learned from that. These guys actually want to be good, and you've got to try and offer constructive criticism. Because in a football dressing, it's not constructive criticism. It's pinning each other up against the wall and shouting at each other. So that wasn't what I was going to do. But that that you did. You did sort of think these people, and Lineker definitely wanted to be as good a presenter as he wanted to be as he was a footballer. Even though he looks relaxed, he was deadly serious about it. I'm not going to be a presenter and be crap at it. You know, it was a sort of a I want to, and he's become probably as good a presenter as he was a footballer, which is a pretty extraordinary thing to do, really. You know.
I mean, to pick up on a point you're saying there about Gary, along with Gary, obviously, you said he wanted to be as good a presenter as he wanted to be a footballer. Was there anybody who came on the show who instantly, when they sat down and done their punditry, you thought they were made for this after they finished their career? Get into it, really, or develop their skills?
Well, you sort of watch people speak. I remember watching... So you want them on to do interviews for you. I mean, Roy Keane was one, because even though he was slightly frightening, he was always going to say something interesting, and he did as a player, you know, the prawn sandwich thing, you know, and they've made him into a kind of must-watch pundit, even if it's sometimes, where the hell's that come from? It is, you know, remarkably compelling. Lee Dixon, in a quieter way, was great. I mean, I'd seen him interview for Arsenal, and he didn't do many interviews because he wasn't the star of the team. You watch him, we all kind of thought, he's going to be really good. Danny Murphy was another one. You see them post-match, and think these people will be quite good. And then you get them in, and particularly these days, because of all the camera angles and what sort of Hanson and Andy Gray did in the early days of punditry, they all want to be doing something new. They all want to be looking for something. You see it now with, you know, Genius and Murphy and those sort of guys. And Shearer's too. They're looking for a different level of analysis. They're not looking... You know, obviously, Carragher and Gary Neville have all that airtime and do it brilliantly. But it all raises the bar, so that they're all looking to think, right, if I'm going to do this, I'm not just going to be looking at the goals or speaking platitudes. I want to do some real proper analysis. You know, and I think, as I say, I think Hanson and Andy Gray started that in the 90s, because before that, the analysis was pretty much literally... Here's the goals. Here's a couple of chances. It was very, very banal, and then they took it to another level, and then it's gone on and on and on. So everybody's coming into it now is thinking, if I want to make an impact here, I'm going to have to bring something to the table, you know. So the standard of analysis is. I mean, you know, people at home often think, well, I'd just rather watch the football, and I kind of get that in a way. But everybody who supports a team wants their team to be analysed. You know, it's that. I don't know who you guys support, but yeah, you if you're watching matches today, you feel a bit cheated if your team's not talked about, don't you?
I'm Tottenham, he's West Ham, so...
Oh, okay, well, there you go, yeah.
You mentioned about the analytics side of it. It's actually quite interesting, because I remember I was watching, it was Rafa Benitez on Sky once, and the way his mind worked and analysed every detail, he was talking about a centre-back, I can't remember what game it was they were playing, but he said about the centre back's foot being sort of 45 degrees out of angle, and if it was in the right position, he'd be able to get the ball. And it's managerial analytics that was really interesting for me.
Yeah, well, coaches have featured sort of more in recent years, haven't they? Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you're looking, but even back to the day, I mean, you know, just it's more simple, but I'd watch a match with Hanson, and he'd say, he didn't say much when he was analysing. He'd almost like lie down on the sofa and grunt a few things. You know, so when I was an assistant producer, I was doing his analysis. So you kind of just noted down everything, thinking what might he come up with. And I got on this sort of on his wavelength, but I never saw football exactly like he did. I see a brilliant goal, and he'd say and he'd mutter something. Same thing happened 10 minutes ago. You dig it out, and it was somebody not tracking a run from midfield, and it was. You know, it's just like, well, I just saw a great goal. I had no idea that somebody had sort of stopped running in the other half. You know, and he could see that. And these guys, and obviously, coaches are looking for things in their team that, I mean, you get the level now of the Guardiolas and the Klopps and the science that's involved. I mean, it would be fascinating, wouldn't it, to get? I know the case you do come on Sky and things, but the sort of forensic stuff they go into now, looking at players. But you watch it, and you think, you know, a lot. You know, I've watched football all my life, and I played football to a reasonable level. I think I have some understanding of it. And you watch it with those people, and you think, right, okay, I'll get my coat and leave you to sort of work out what you want to talk about. So you don't, you know, you kind of all I could do as the editor was try and understand what they were saying. So I thought I was quite a good layman for that. I thought if you run this analysis past me and explain it to me, do I understand it? And or am I learning anything? So I always got them to sort of do a dry run, but often you just battle their judgment. You just think, well, if you think that's all about the defenders being at fault, and I think it's a great goal, you're probably right. You know,
You mentioned Alan Hansen now, so you can probably guess what I'm going to bring
oh,
us.
Oh, yes.
I read a part in an interview, something about possibly being a little bit tipsy on live set.
Well, I think he wasn't tipsy, so hungover possibly, yeah. And I wouldn't accuse him of having drunk before a programme. But
oh, of course.
We were, yeah, it was about 2004, and I was doing the programme. We had a brand new director, because I was the sort of editor doing the running orders and the kind of like the map reader, and the guy next to me was the director calling the cameras and like the rally. I was called a rally driver and a navigator. It was kind of my map, but he would be putting it on the air. And Hansen had turned up. We'd done a game the previous night. We'd done Man United Arsenal. Then he got to somebody's 50th birthday, probably one of his ex-Liverpool colleagues or something, in Merseyside. We'd all gone on to Wolves. It was Wolves Rochdale. It was Sunday afternoon, BBC Two. And he turned up. And he had been out. He'd obviously... I mean, he hadn't been drinking all... he wasn't that unprofessional, but he was a bit tired. And we'd all been watching Man U Arsenal. And that was the big game of the weekend. And this one, I was trying to stoke up some interest. It was Wolves Rochdale. Rochdale haven't been in the fifth round of the cup ever or whatever it was. So I was, you know, I like all that. Romance of the cup, but Hansen's a bit of a big club man, really. This wasn't really tickling his fancy very much, so he just sat there. And Mark Lawrence was on with him, and knew what's the guy called? He was the Rochdale manager at the time, who he'd known from lower league somewhere. It was Carlisle manager as well. I forgot the guy's name. It'll come back to me. But so he was going to talk about Rochdale. So we've done a little feature on Rochdale. Isn't it amazing they've got the fifth round? What a big day for them. So he was going to talk about that. And we sort of thought, well, Alan, you won the league here at Molineux when it was a completely different ground and Liverpool fans came in off the street. He said, oh, I'll talk about that. So we did the rehearsal and Lineker, we did this little bit of it, Loro. And Lineker said, OK, well, Alan, you won the league here, didn't you? And he just muttered and sort of was reading the running order and not really paying any attention. Yeah. So we came on the air, and it's quite obviously, BBC One were counting us on, the whole of the rest of it. And they went to Alan Hansen, and he still thought they were rehearsing. So I've got a brand new director with me, who at this point is just like, looking at me like this. And Lineker looks at the, am I allowed to swear on this? I'll self-censor. But anyway, Lineker, so this, Hansen's got a looking down, not paying any attention at all. And Loro, and then eventually Lineker just sort of turns to the camera and says, are we on the air here? And I basically said to the director, just completely lost. He didn't know what to say anymore. And I said, I'm not supposed to be speaking, but I show too effing right you are. So he just stood and he talked absolute rubbish. He suddenly realized he was online. The whole story came out like, it was like the Eric Morecambe thing about all the right words, but not in the right, necessarily in the right order. It was a kind of just a word salad came out, and we had to just get into whatever bit of VT we had. We went back to the office. That was absolutely awful. It was almost excruciating, embarrassing bit of telly. And people back at the office, most of them hadn't seen it because it was on BBC Two. And the ones who had, was that not some kind of in-joke? We're not just, so we go away with it. If it was now, I mean, I think it came up in his documentary when he left the BBC, and he mentioned me by name. So he didn't say exactly what I said, but screaming in his ear. And yeah, they brought it up and said that was one of the most embarrassing moments of his career. But these days it would be on YouTube, it would be everywhere. We got away with it completely. I think it only sort of resurfaced really for that documentary when he actually left about 10 years later. But it was, yeah, I aged about 10 years in that. It was just horrible. But we got away with it, you know, so there you go.
Another clip I made dig out and saw on YouTube, made me laugh a couple of times today, was an exchange between former Take That of Robbie Williams and Ireland, now Nottingham Forest, former Nottingham Forest manager Martin O'Neill.
That was fantastic. I was actually an assistant producer then. I'd been promoted. I was going to become assistant editor for the 98-99 season. So it was actually just a fantastic thing for me to work on. So I did all the music items and stuff, but I was kind of, didn't have that much responsibility. It was a lovely, we were in Paris for 5 weeks. And Martin was great. It was the first tournament Martin had done, and he was full of, he went around and met everybody behind the scenes, immediately charmed everybody, done all this research, was full of, full of beans about it. And then Robbie Williams basically, I think, turned up at the door. He'd worked, because we were up above the Place de la Concorde, he'd worked out where it was, and he came with a sort of mate or whatever, and just came and literally knocked on the door. And the production manager sort of found me as a sort of the only person who, was anything to do with the programme team. I happened to be hanging around the office. So I sort of took him, I said, I don't think the woman who met him at the door knew who he was, but I was like the most famous person in Britain at the time. And he had a Des's God t-shirt on, and I thought, well, do you want to come on the air? So it was like, they're in the middle of a game. So I just took him up, and Niall Sloane, who was editing, said, yeah, blimey, bring him in. So we brought him in at half time. And he just thought he was going to get the soft soap of, you know, what do you think the tournament so far? Isn't Paris great and all that from Dez? But for some reason, I still don't understand it to this day. I think O'Neill thought he was being funny. We just rounded on him. He said, you haven't got any talent, have you? You're useless. He said, Gary Barlow writes all the songs. What do you do? You know, Robbie Williams is just reeling. I haven't actually seen it back. I must watch it. It was basically what happened, wasn't it? Robbie Williams is like,
What have I come on to here? It's very entertaining.
It's brilliant, but it's mad. It was mad. And that's Martin all over. Martin thought he was joking and just was... I don't think Robbie Williams just thought, what do I do? I'm on live telly here. This bloke's been horrible to me. But yeah, that was just a sensational bit of telly. I mean, you couldn't have made that one up. But it was, yeah, just, I don't think Martin realised what he did. Even when he came off the air, there's always the phones were lighting up with what's that rude man just said to Robbie Williams. He still didn't really know what he'd done. He was a great bloke, Martin O'Neill. Just a fantastic. Yeah, he was so interested in things apart from football as well. You could sit and talk to him about anything. You know, he'd done a law degree, and he was a really unusual. And he had a massive lifelong rivalry, really, with Brian Clough. Because Brian Clough, being a very clever psychologist, used to call him Clever Clogs and wind him up horribly. I'd always praised John Robertson, who was became Martin's assistant at Villa and things, but was a gifted but sort of slightly lazy player. Well, not lazy, but a kind of a winger, you know, classic sort of winger. And Martin would be working his backside off to get the ball out to O'Neill, to Robertson. And basically, Clough would tell him, you know, don't do anything with the ball apart from give it to your mate. And if you try to do anything, had a shot or try to play a long ball, he would get an absolute, you know, bollocking at half time. And that just fired him up. And he was still even after sort of, I think, even Clough had died, or certainly when we were talking to him, he was still completely wound up about it. He spent the rest of his life trying to prove Brian Clough wrong, really. So I guess he did it, yeah, because he became a very good manager himself. But there you go.
Just one more from me. So, in terms of your career, what would you say your best memory from everything that you've produced, edited, been involved in? What's your best memory from your career?
Well, I loved that. I mean, it's funny, that 98 World Cup, because it was the last one before I started. You don't enjoy them so much when it's the ultimate responsibility. I always sort of regard myself as the worrier in chief once I was doing the programme, because if anything unexpected happened, like the time that BBC One, we struggled to stay on the air when we had the extra time of penalties in the Steven Gerrard Cup final. And that just became me having this ridiculous argument. There's a guy saying, hang on, we're in extra time. What happens if that's still level, you know, if it's still 3-3 at the end of extra time? Well, we've got penalties. We've got Doctor Who on. We had this whole thing. And I was just absolutely, it's in the book, but it's just a ridiculous story. And then we weren't staying on for the presentation. So I had all that sort of, just, you can't do this. You can't do this to us. And all of that became me, whereas in 98, I was just making little creative bits and kind of flouncing around, really, and enjoying. And I was younger, so you could stay up later and all that kind of stuff. And 92, Barcelona Olympics in 92 was the first trip I did. It was amazing, just amazing. I hadn't been on a big event at all. But Barcelona was fantastic. And again, I didn't have a lot of responsibility. Of the ones when I was editor, I think probably Brazil in 2014, just because it was just, you know, perfect. And it was the last big tournament. I sort of knew I wasn't going to do too many more. I left a bit earlier, so the year or so later, but it was amazing when it bowed out, because it's the football place. Yeah. I've always loved Brazil. I mean, I know they completely balls it up, lost 7-1, but which is very strange, very strange in itself. Being in Rio, it was literally like a mass funeral. I've never seen anything like it. But other than that, it was an amazing trip. So that would probably, and the other was 2012, actually, the Olympics, which again is outside of football. But I was an editor on that, and although there were loads of us doing programmes, I didn't have the same overall responsibility. But it was just that just went like a dream, really. I mean, you know, to be honest, everything's gone wrong with the country ever since, really, hasn't it? It's been sort of downhill all the way. That was just an amazing peak from the opening ceremony onwards. So I doing that in your own city was pretty great too.
Yeah.
Paul, you mentioned earlier you had a book out last year, Why Are We Always On Last? Just for our listeners, where would they have to pick up a copy of that?
It's still, I think it certainly has been, it is on Amazon and was in bookshops and stuff. For about a week, it actually was the top-selling TV production book, and then some little whippersnapper called David Attenborough knocked it off, which was about a 20-year-old book, by the way. But there you go. It's just for a week, I was anyway. So it was, and Lineker did the foreword, and it's sort of because I'm not there anymore. I mean, I'm not. It's not a, you know, it's not a muckraking book, but I've been able to tell a few stories honestly, like that, Stephen Gerrard story, and like the Alan Hansen my side of that, and also a fair bit of explanation of how the sort of how the mechanics of how the program comes together, because people always want to know that, and that's quite a long winded. Because I really, as the editor, you're the only person working on Match of the Day, really, during the week. Everybody else is, you haven't got that many permanent people working there anymore, really. It's like freelancers, but Football Focus is labour intensive because people have to go off and make films and do edits for it. Match of the Day is just a bit of planning, and then it all happens on the day. So that was me, really, for a decade or so. So, you know, and try not to, I mean, all you ever are is the custodian. You can't, you're not going to reinvent it. Or if you did, you'd be an idiot, really, because it's basically, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But it has evolved. You know, if you look back at the programs I first work on, they do look different, but it's, you do it gradually so that people don't feel like they're, you know, watching. It's just not a program you'd want to, they once rearrange the theme music and the questions asked in Parliament. You know, it's that kind of level of, you've got to be careful what you're doing with it, really.
Never rearrange the theme music, I've got to say.
Well, exactly. Somebody back in the, sort of like, I think like the early 90s, decided to sort of sweep it up a bit and put a bit of, you know, sort of funky production on it. Because it's a very old piece of music, and it just lasted about two. I think we had only had the FA Cup at the time, so it lasted for the first and second round of the FA Cup until some MP spotted it and said, "Oh, this is an outrage, what's going on?" And they sort of quietly withdrew it again. So, yeah, so you can't, you know, it's an institution, and I did always feel I was the custodian. I thought all I'm doing here is just kind of looking after it. Yeah. When I left, my assistant editor became the editor, just like I'd become the editor and having been assistant editor. So there's a sort of continuity on it, as there has been presenters and commentators, there's far more of them now, but there's a sort of a, you know, you're not going to suddenly watch Match of the Day one week and it's going to be radically different or have radically different people on it, you know. I know that can make it a bit cozy and a bit familiar, but, you know, it's better that way than trying to do anything too radical with it, I always thought. That was my excuse, and it probably meant I haven't got any imagination. That was probably what really happened.
Yeah, that's everything from me.
Yeah.
Oh, we really, 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 really appreciate it.
Oh, not at all. So, Chris, you're going to get the season called off then?
We hope so. Yeah,
It's almost like she hasn't noticed, isn't it? It's like, well, it'd be very cruel in Liverpool. Oh, yeah, actually, we wouldn't get relegated, would we? That'll be a bonus, yeah.
I think from my side, I think the Tottenham fans are calling out for a season to be called off.
Yes, I think you've had enough. I've got a lot of Tottenham friends, actually. I've got a curry. I go for when we were at Wembley, we used to go a lot of the games, because I live in that sort of direction. And I've got a load of Spurs mates, and I think, yes, they're not exactly wild about your new manager, are they? It's not really fit, is it?
We've had a couple of conversations about this. I'm not convinced as yet. I'm not convinced. Last game I went to was a game against Wolves, where we were...
I was at that, yeah.
Yeah, and we managed to throw it away, and it was really, really fun. It was a lot of fun. That was just...
Well, I enjoyed watching Adama Traore, because he's the most exciting player Borough had since Juninho, and he shouldn't have been in the Championship, but he's fantastic, isn't he? But, so I quite enjoyed that, because I got Spurs, and I'm kind of neutral, but... I just thought Wolves did counter attack very well out there, but yeah, you threw it away as the Spurs fan.
Yeah, big time. I think I might have left about 75 minutes.
I think my mates did. I think I was meant to meet them afterwards, and most of them had gone home. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know what? I think I've had enough. I just went home.
Yeah, yeah. West Ham's not been too smooth really since he moved grounds, has it? It's not quite.
No, it hasn't.
It's great for 2012. A bit less good for football, unfortunately, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I think that the move was such a big risk in the first place. They've now got the retractable seats,
yeah. So
they need enough time to fit them in. But if that's going to make a massive difference, I don't know.
I went to see Borough there, the one season we were in the Premier League in recent years. Yeah. And I've never been further away from the pitch. It was the day that, actually, I was quite grateful because Payet scored that incredible goal. But he scored about five yards away. We kind of vaguely thought that looked amazing, but I don't know, like, if you had binoculars, you might have seen it.
Chris has never mentioned that goal before.
that was before they even got the police. It was all a bit mad at that point. It was like, it was just anarchy. There was no police. There was no anything. It was sort of making up as they went along, weren't they? The security. Our lot, they had all those tarpaulins down between in the middle of the away end. It was like a lot of guys trampolining on it. It was absolutely bonkers.
But it's
settled down a bit since then, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that. I mean, I've been to quite quite a fair amount of games. I don't think I've seen any violence in any game I've been to. I mean, I've been to a fair few, but like you said,
it wasn't bad. I mean, it was just a bit old school because there was nothing. Yeah. There was nothing really. I think also the West Ham fans were just cheesed off with the entire thing, and we were, you know.
I think the big one for me was whenever Chelsea came to West Ham.
Yeah.
That was where it got blown out of proportion after that, because it was that one game that made a massive problem.
But it did mean they had to. I think they were basically told, if you don't start giving the police some radios and pull your finger out, we're gonna sort of shove bits of the ground out of there. At that point, it all sort of, you know, suddenly they found a way of getting it properly secure against the proper stewards and police and everything, which was. I was there, but it was about the third game when Borough were there, so it just was sort of they were making up as they went along. Really. Yeah. It wasn't. You know, I live to tell the tale, but it was a wee bit hairy. It wasn't entirely West Ham fans' fault either. We have a few of those sort of people as well. So, you know.
Paul, some absolutely fantastic stories there.
Any time, guys. No, lovely to talk to you. I'm bored stiff, so it's lovely. I mean, I've left my wife watching some horrible Scandi drama in the other room. I'm more than happy to talk football.
No problem at all, Paul. We hope to have you on again soon. We really, really appreciate you taking time out.
Oh, look, I've got just a little thing. Shakhtar Donetsk mug. I've just realised. So that was Euro. Euro 2012, I went and found the Euro club shop. We did a game in Donetsk, so I kind of had to. So, I went and found the club shop. So, there you go. Just
as many souvenirs as you can get, Paul. As many souvenirs as you can get.
Yeah, Paul, absolutely. Yeah.
We hope to speak to you again very, very soon. And take care. No, stay safe.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, lads. Good luck with the podcast and everything. I hope it's a big success for you.
Perfect.
I'm hoping you'll get back, Paul, out there and actually watch some football at some point.
Yeah, exactly. We hope to be out there again soon.
What, one day, anyway. Yeah, I hope so.
One day. Okay.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, Paul.
Right.
Fantastic interview there with Paul Armstrong. Great to get some insights into him producing and working with the BBC on programmes like Match of the Day as well as the Olympics. It was good to hear some funny stories as well, like the exchange between Robbie Williams and Martin O'Neill.
And also the one with Alan Hansen, obviously being hungover on set, it's not ideal. And you just have that image of the camera going to him and him just being, not even realising that they're live, and then Gary Lineker's reaction to that. It was a brilliant interview, great conversation with him. That's everything for this week, guys. Obviously, we're going to be doing this every week. So remember to hit subscribe on the YouTube. And make sure you tune in on
podcast. Or if it's my side, hit subscribe on this side.
And share it with everyone that you know as well that will be interested in listening to the podcast. Leave some comments if there's any topics you want us to talk about. Always happy for some feedback, all right?
Fantastic, guys. We really appreciate you taking time to watch Gaming Too Hard podcast, and we will see you again very, very soon. Super.